Okay. Who wants to be first? Any questions, comments?
I was just wondering if you could elaborate a bit more about the, you know, sort of the comparison of mindsets between people who are sort of active and sort of moving things at that time, and how that compares with, you know, the kind of sort of mindset that might be around in the community in a future evolution, in terms of their views on class consciousness, or their views on the future, or their views on authority and how that related to themselves. Just wondering, you know, if make a or expand a bit more on the comparisons between sort of how people were thinking then and how people will think in a sort of pre-revolutionary time in the future.
Yes, so I don't think that what I get clearly coming through the books I've read on this is that they didn't have any grand theories or plans or ideas for where they wanted to go. There was no concept. I think this is one of these things where I said that there's a huge difference between our revolution and theirs, was that they were able to just go ahead. Whilst there were examples on the continent of, you know, the Italian city-states and the communes in France and the liberties that were available to a city, and that they had a clear notion of how a city, free city, could be run among its members as a sworn commune. I don't think that they had any grand design for this idea of, well, what we'll have is a constitutional monarchy with a parliament and regular elections. These things kind of emerged from it. I mean, one of the things that emerged I didn't mention is de Montfort summoned the first parliament without the king's backing. You know, so that was one of the events. This was the kind of like the war that kind of really cemented parliament into English life. But I think that the other mindset, and I think this is one of the things I wanted to bring out, is that, you know, we see feudalism very much as being the king was in charge and everyone had to obey, whereas in fact there was quite substantial layers of local government and people were running their own lives fairly substantially in places like London that had a clear idea of how it ran itself, and they were fighting very much to defend what they were already doing. And I think that's one of those things, one of these big debates: will people rebel to gain something, or will they rebel chiefly to defend something, and what they have gets transformed in the revolution? So it's very much like the things that happened in Spain. People would have rebelled initially to defend democracy, but in the end had to start making all sorts of changes to how things ran because they'd taken charge. I'll just say I did witter on for a very long time, thoroughly understanding there weren't going to be very many questions coming out of this.
Could I ask something, Bill? From the Robber Barons to where you finished your story, how long was that?
So the story of Will Withers was 1233.
Yeah.
And the Second Barons' War comes to an end 1265, I think, or 1270. It's kind of like the dates I've got elsewhere for where things... Yeah, 1265 is when de Montfort dies.
So a lot of things happened in a very, very short period of time.
Yes, between things kicking off for Henry, 1258, to the actual Civil War, 1263, that's another 5 years. So it wasn't happening at breakneck modern speed, but, you know, the stages are recognisable. You know, the Parliament's summoned, the king is surrounded and captured, the king plays attack. This is all the events of 1645 exactly mirrored. And I do wonder, I have no idea how much people in the 17th century knew of what happened in the 13th. I don't know if it would have been very common history, but certainly it's remarkable how similar this is to the English and the later English and the French revolutions in terms of the actual processes that are undergone. And I suppose later revolutions, because a lot of revolutions take the form of a group of people come along, they depose the existing government, a provisional government is formed, and then the reactionaries regroup and take power back, and then there's further wars and this sort of thing. So it seems to be a fairly common pattern through history.
So there's hope for us yet.
In our times, we had the poll tax riots, and I'm sort of drawing a parallel between some of these tax riots, which you could call them, to the beginning of a revolution against tax with the poll taxes, you know, and I think it was aiming towards some sort of revolution there. You know, how would you see that?
So yeah, the time of the Thatcherite poll tax. Yeah, so I mean, very famously, Thatcher refused to call it the poll tax until one time when she slipped up in Parliament. Poll tax was the name given it by its enemies, who were recalling the poll tax that preceded the Peasants' Revolt. And yes, personal taxation on people and blatant taxation. So, what I suppose brings up one of the big differences between exploitation under feudalism, where they come along and say, "I'm taking some wealth off you," whereas we are exploited chiefly through the extraction of surplus value, where we're paid the full rate for our labour power, and then they underhandedly take the wealth that we've created, and that's how we're exploited now. So coming along and trying to raise a poll tax on individuals under capitalism would have the same result, pretty much as doing it under feudalism, which is you're coming along, blatantly taking things away from people, and if they feel it's harmful and they haven't voted for this and they don't understand it. And in some ways, there were some fairly liberal arguments for the poll tax. You know, there should be some sort of personal taxation, and that local authorities should be accountable in the form that people can see exactly how much they're paying for what the services are. I mean, you know, they can make some good arguments for that sort of thing, but obviously you go along to people who have no money at all and try and take some off them, then, you know, they're going to go to the nearest available recourse. And then if you've got people who are aware of the antecedents of, you know, the poll tax led to the Peasants' Revolt, they therefore go, well, you've tried this, you know, Tony Benn and the like, we're going, well, you tried this before, and this is what happened then, and we're trying to do the same thing now. So, you know, it's that's one of the things that the role of history in contemporary politics.
Yeah. And I think the other two things which are really taxing, well, which were quite unpopular, was the third bedroom tax for council tenants, and the VAT, which is a tax on sanitary towels, which I think is completely unnecessary from Margaret, you know, Thatcher as well. Now, how would you see that in the overall context?
No, well, now isn't the time to get into the slightly longer argument that we would understand that I have to phrase it carefully because some people get very touchy about this. The burden of taxation can't actually fall on the working class. Ultimately, if they try and tax us in any way, then our wages compensate for it. Yeah. And the burden doesn't fall on us. That's the very short version. But there is the symbolism of, like you say, of a tax on sanitary products or on when other things that are deemed necessaries are exempted. And it doesn't. It is appalling, absolutely, and things like the bedroom tax, which absolutely, you know, they weren't. It was the main thing. The horror of it was discriminatory towards renters, whereas if anyone, you know, they said it was some sort of measure to try and free up space, but you know they weren't doing anything to people who actually owned houses. It was just some sort of wide scale attack on the poor again. And again, it's in political terms, it's the visibility that's the thing that undoes them. Whereas, again, our understanding of exploitation is that it's done invisibly, and we only notice it when someone says, "Well, look, you know, why are they millionaires and why aren't you?"
Yeah.
Okay, Sibeli, and then Howard.
Very interesting kind of panorama you put there. One thing I would like you to kind of roll here. Again with me, because I understand when you have the mercantilism and the feudalism, and then since then the parliament, because I was quite very curious to understand when actually the parliament itself was established and how they actually was agreed to, let's say, control the communes, and at the same time when actually the monarchy, and we talk about here in the monarchy and the parliament, how they actually work together, and how since then feudalism, mercantilism, and whatever, we get today balanced with the commune, parliament, and the monarchy, because these powers spread like that. And as well, how actually the currencies and money was dealt on the mercantilism.
Okay, I'll try. So what you're basically asking, so your first question, as I understand it, is when did the Parliament come about? Well, the Parliaments, the first one that was summoned came about around about 1200, and that was King John, and this was as a result of Magna Carta, where he had to ask for permission to raise taxes. So up until then, I mean, in many ways, the king was just another feudal magnate. And, you know, when you look at all the list of titles that John had, he was the Count of Anjou, he was the Duke of Normandy, and he didn't really rank King of England any higher than the rest of them. And in fact, he fought a vicious war to maintain his position as the Count of Anjou. He was just one more feudal magnate among many, and you know, he, as the Duke of Normandy, he owed fealty to the King of France, for instance, and that was one of the things that caused a lot of the problems of the French War. So the whole sort of like European system of nobility wasn't based on any country. They just, like I said, you know, the De Bruce family, who were the kings of Scotland, owned lands in England. So the first parliaments that came along, they weren't really elected in the way that we would understand today. It was just a summoning of the knights of the shires and the barons, and then it became a much more formalised thing that each county would send along a delegate or representative and this sort of thing, and that kind of evolved at this time. So this is the key struggle between the personal monarchy. The king wants to have the right to rule in their own right, and people turn around and say, no, you have to follow some rules. And there are other people who could set rules for you. Now, you can change those rules by their permission, but you've got to bring us on board. The change to mercantilism, like I say, you can look at the posters through there, comes a lot later. And really, that's the 17th century, and very much depends on the discovery of the New World. Because then you've got colonies and you can have trade with the colonies, and the notion of merchant capital. I mean, the spice road was in existence and spices were coming, and you know, there was, I can't remember which king it was, had a right to £2 worth of pepper. He was being kept as a prisoner. I think it might be Richard. Because he had to pepper his meat, and of course pepper was only coming from the Far East. Mercantilism rose up from these connections and comes a lot later. I think it's more by the Elizabethan time, and of course the roadblock on the way is the Great Plague, which comes 100 years after the events here, which sets everything back because it kills a third of everyone, and changed things quite dramatically. I hope that answers your question.
Howard?
Just a reflection. What Bill's been describing happened a relatively short time ago in the span of human history, less than 800 years. Mm. When you consider that humankind has been around, well, it seems to be getting pushed back further and further into the past. I mean, about 50 years ago, it was thought that Homo sapiens has been around for about 40,000 years. But now it's generally considered it's a lot longer than that, perhaps closer to 200,000 years. So really 800 years in a span of 200,000 years history, that's a very short time indeed, isn't it? And if you were able to go back 800 years and speak to some of the people involved in these events and describe what society was like now, certainly in the most advanced parts of the world, they wouldn't be able to imagine it, they wouldn't have any idea what you were talking about. And yeah, it's a relatively short time. And just to say, and this reminds me of something I think the first speaker said on the first evening, Edmund Griffiths, said, what's not realistic at one moment may become realistic later. So the thing to say to the people in the 13th century was, well, it may not seem realistic now, but it will be realistic later. Mm. In the same way, if people say to us, well, what you're advocating isn't realistic, we can say the same thing. Well, it may not seem realistic now, but it doesn't mean to say it won't be realistic in the very near future indeed. Far less than 800 years, we hope.
Well, I mean, part of this talk is a follow-on to one that I did a couple of years ago about one of my favourite William Morris novellas, I think you'd have to call it, A Dream of John Ball, in which very expressly he does just that. He writes himself, rather than like News from Norway, writing himself into the future, he writes himself back to the Peasants' Revolt and says, well, you're having this revolt that will lead to all of this. You're going to free yourselves from these oppressions, but I'm sorry, you're going to end up with as workers and with this different set of oppressors. And it's a very, I would thoroughly recommend to anyone to get a copy. It's a very beautiful book. And part of my thought is, you know, the infamous Lenin, you know, without the vanguard party, the revolution will take 500 years. Well, for the burghers of London, if their first revolution was in 1263, skip forward 400 years, to 1650s, when the apprentices of London are at the head of the Commonwealth. And the English Revolution. So you know they didn't win the first time. This is obviously the early days of their first sort of like their first revolts against the system. But they did win eventually. You know, and the conditions you know weren't right for them at the start. But that didn't stop them from fighting their corner because they were very up against a still vigorous feudal class that were personally involved in the warfare, whereas by later time, you know, almost all the fighters were mercenaries, which meant, of course, that they were of a sort of form of business. And we get to the point that Graeber makes about the mercantile classes allying themselves, and they go around the world conquering colonies and begin the primary accumulation necessary for capital.
Celeste?
I think I skipped all my history classes, so pale for me. I think I understand that you said between feudalism and capitalism was a phase called pre-capitalism. I don't know if it was the mercantilism you talked. And then you're linking with what was said yesterday about how to live as a socialist in the capitalism world. Would be a pre-socialist phase, and what are the means to achieve socialism in the future to come? Do you expect some rebellions before the revolution to complete? Was your captain, Thomas, something, forgot his name, was he a rebellion or was he a revolutionary?
Question. So when I talk about pre-capitalist, I don't think that was necessarily a phase. I wouldn't call it a phase. It was the processes whereby the preconditions for capitalism to come into being were being set up. So things like clearing peasants off the land to make way for sheep, and then that, and then the sheep are sold overseas to get hold of money. And this starts to bring about the kind of the commodity relationship and the generalisation of commodities. And of course, clearing people from the land created the possibility for free labour, because suddenly there were now landless peasants around, and they would be soaked up into the towns. I think there will almost certainly be further revolts and struggles against. I mean, we're seeing things like, you know, we're talking about lies and things. Puerto Rico, just this week, mass movement on the streets has just deposed the governor. It has hardly made the ripple of the news. You know, this is a US colony that some people think should be a state of the union, has just had such disgust with it. They've gone out on the streets and said, right, you out, and they have. And I think that there'll be lots more of that sort of thing. But just as the conditions for capitalism existed within feudalism, I think that now the pre-socialist conditions, we engage in collaborative labour in our workplaces. We don't sell our products onto each stage in any workplace. We work together. We're all trained to work as teams, to collaborate, to know who to go to. And you don't I don't ring up another department and go, I will give you £5 if you could send this email to the IT team. And they'll go, oh no, it'll cost you 10. I mean, we don't do that. We're part of a large collaborative process whereby everyone goes, yeah, okay, I'll get onto it, and everyone knows what they're doing. So very clearly that we don't just have the material capacity, we already have everything we need to run a socialist society within our own experiences within capitalism. Thomas Fitz Thomas, was he a rebel? I mean, clearly he threw his lot in with the rebels fairly quickly, and whether he was just saving his own position, I don't. It's obviously it's too far ago. We don't have any first hand records. All we know is that he fell in with fairly enthusiastically with de Montfort. He seems to have fallen in and used the folk moot. He could have resisted. He could have got sacked. Whether he was just saving his own position or whether he was a bit like a Tony Benn, you know, a scion of the older regime, suddenly discovering radicalism and joining in with the new revolt, it's impossible to tell. But what we know is that he did sort of like have this fairly radical communal regime, and he saw through these changes and saw through recognitions of the crafts. And I can only assume that he was a revolutionary of... He was a fairly consistent and conscious one, and the fact that he organised to save the Queen when she was being beset by the mob, and that he organised sanctuary for the Jews when the mob was against them, suggests that there may be some noble characteristics that are worth looking into the guy, but we really can't tell, because, you know, he is a footnote in history, essentially.
Janet, then Joy.
Yeah, thank you. Various things have sort of come together in my head from Edmund, from Howard, from what you've just given us, which is great. And I want to ask what your view is on this bit, the way I'm sort of trying to link it. We're looking at this, the possibility, how long it can take for something to happen, hundreds of years, thousands of years, whatever it is, the various progressions. And I see that, and I accept it. What I come back to, what I'm thinking about such a lot of the time, and you will know this because I said it yesterday, my worry, if you like, my big concern is time, the time frame of what we have. Now we're looking at what we know about the problems of the climate on Earth, the changes that are coming very quickly. And I imagine most people here are convinced that it's happening very quickly and it's speeding up. And there's going to be a lot of chaos on the planet for people all over the place, having to move in great numbers, having to deal with more severe weather conditions, possibly not being able to find places that they can live because there's too many moving all at the same time. And it's bound to have an impact on what we hear about, and I cannot in my own mind put this together that I can come to any kind of knowing what on earth could the scenario be like, or all kinds of different scenarios, I'm sure. And I feel I'd be interested if you've had a view on this up to now, or whether you started thinking about it, and other people too. That's it, really.
So in some ways, I'll make the comparison between the events I'm describing and 1848. So when Marx is seeing the working class emerging for the first time during the middle of what were essentially still bourgeois revolutions against later feudal states, but the working class was now an independent party to these. I'm saying, and like the burghers of London asserting their equality with the barons, the workers asserted their equality with the burghers, and that's only 150 years ago. And again, that was at a time in which there was a mature or maturing capitalism, and the workers were just appearing. Now, as you say, are we running out of time, and do we need to get it on? I was struck by someone who came up with a fairly convincing argument that, rather horrifyingly, from a certain like Donald Trump style point of view, genocide is a functional solution for global climate change, which it's not for us, because we're the ones who get genocided. But you know, if you think you're the multimillionaire who can pay a group of people to take you to a mountain fastness where, if the very worst happens, all you have to do... And billionaires are actually seriously talking to us about how do we secure the loyalty of our security retinues in the event of an apocalyptic scenario where we are trying to survive against the rest of the world. And you know, the, so I'm afraid that to say that yes, so that socialism is not the only solution, but it's the only one that's going to work for us. And in terms of, I've no idea if we're going to get our act together in time. As I was saying, one of my themes for the weekend is that lying seems to be unreasonably effective, and distortions. Although I don't know what the counter to that really is. And we'll have to see. And I think, I suppose, the real counter to lies is experience. You can't get people to deny what's in front of their own eyes. And a lot of what's happening is that, you know, people are getting hot and bothered about, you know, the Mexico border. It's a long way from where they live. And it tends to be people who are a long way from where the migrants are coming who really don't like them. And the people actually in the areas, you know, anyone living in London, is now, you know, my family up north think London is lost. You know, that's the way they phrase it. You know, whereas those living there are going, it's great, loads of people, different parts of the world, all over the place. Brilliant. But I think that the message that it took a revolt to get us where we are, it took, and that they didn't necessarily have to have a finalised, worked-out utopian plan for a medieval city. They were just doing what they knew already. They didn't have to, you know, no one was going to, yeah, but what are you going to do about the fishermen? You know, or anything like that. They weren't having to come up with a plan for a future London. They just had to go, well, look, you know, we'd like to assert our right to run things the way we know how to run them.
Okay, Joy?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, yesterday I was indulging in one of my favourite pastimes, and that's listening into other people's conversations. And I noticed that somebody mentioned, a visitor mentioned, that in the Declaration of Principles, it says something about declaring war or waging war, and the word war seemed to alarm a few people. And I just wondered if you could address that point.
Right, well, yes, it does say to wage war on all parties, whether alleged labour or avowedly capitalist. I don't think it says political war, does it? No. Not that I've memorised it or anything. And this has been one of the controversies that has run for many years when we talk about war. But then again, we talk about class war. We don't necessarily mean shooting in the streets and you know, riots or we're going to hunt them down or anything like that. It is that we are aggressively trying to oppose them, and that we won't cut any deals. We're not in the business of trying to join alliances with any faction of the capitalist class to achieve our ends, and that only by clearly and consistently putting forward the case for socialism. And again, this comes back to what I said about our revolution will have to be different from this. These bourgeois revolutions, whereby they could be the head at the, of an unconscious mass, as the line goes. We know that we will have to have a lot of people agreeing and deciding to make socialism, and this is why I think it's necessary to look at history and get the idea of why the revolutions took the form that they did and had to at the time. But absolutely there's no way that we're going to end up with a socialist party cabal suddenly find themselves having chased Prime Minister Corbyn out of office and sat there round the cabinet table in Downing Street going, now what the hell do we do? You know, nothing like that could possibly happen. What will have to happen is millions and millions and millions of meetings like this. Rather terrifying and as a concept, because Mike's going to have to organise them all.
It's 1904 speak, anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, the Declaration.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just an historical document. Keith, is it Keith?
Yeah, Bill has kind of made my point for me that I was going to make. I was just underlining that. I think it's a really interesting project to look at earlier revolutions and make the comparison with the one that we're trying to get people to make. And I think the point's well taken that it would be a complete parody to think of those earlier revolutions as ones where a bunch of people get together and say, hey, why don't we get rid of feudal relations? Why don't we have some capitalist relations and a new social formation? It doesn't work like that. People bring a new society into existence without necessarily intending to or knowing exactly what they were doing. Beyond that, I would have thought the main point of comparison with the revolution that we're advocating is one of contrasts, that people precisely do have to know what they're doing. As Marx put it, the socialist revolution is the movement of the independent, self-conscious majority in the interest of the majority. And the self-consciousness is the point that I think you just made and I would want to underline. People have got to know where they're going. They have got to intend to bring that result about. Because of the nature of a socialist society, they've got to know what they're in for. They've got to be prepared, behave in such a way as to shore it up. And I just thought that's really the main point of contrast between us and vanguard parties. People sign up to Lenin's idea that working people by their own efforts can only achieve trade union consciousness, not revolutionary consciousness. If there's no reason to believe that Lenin is right about that. And if he were, well, then, given the nature of socialist society, to put it politely, we'd all be fucked anyway.
Nothing to add, just agree.
Okay, Patty. It's Patty, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And then... I think it was my conversation you were seeing.
I'm sorry, yeah,
on that. Because that is something that I struggle with, this outdated language in these principles. And... I think all principles are open to flexibility. A principle, a personal principle of mine might be that I won't steal. It's in a lot of religious codes, it's whatever, ethical. But, if my family was starving, I would steal, if there was whatever. So, there has to be progress with these as well. And I think as a newcomer coming into this, that's the last thing that I read in the socialist standard. And it is very kind of like insightful language. It's encouraging activism and all of this sort of thing. And, then I come here and I listen to, a lot of very sort of like intelligent talk and reference to, theorists and whatever. But actually, I don't see that there has been a great deal of progress in accomplishing a socialist movement in the world or whatever. So, it's like all things. I mean, yesterday we were talking about religion and whatever. And, I kind of like have a little bit of a thing with that as well, because actually religion is progressive. There's a lot of now, when we look at churches and religions, there's a lot more kind of inclusion with LGBT, with females, being in a position of power. It's not this patriarchal thing that it was back then. And I wonder if perhaps we're judging, religion and stuff by these outdated standards that were in place in 1904. The God that I believe in is a socialist. It would be a God who is inclusive. Maybe the money thing and all of this isn't part of that, but in terms of the values and the ideals, that is what it's part of. So I don't see why, when science now is very much kind of marrying with religion, spirituality, whatever you say, why can't the socialist party also be kind of making a move to being inclusive and encouraging different viewpoints, religious or spiritual or whatever? Somebody mentioned the Buddhists yesterday. I mean, there's also the Quakers right next door or whatever. I think there would be a lot of points of reference with religious groups like the Quakers, and I think a lot of things that kind of make me hesitant about the Socialist Party is the fact that there doesn't seem that progression. We talk about a revolution which is active, but now it seems quite latent. Where is the... Sorry.
No.
I don't mean to be dead sad because I'm really interested in this, but I do have a lot of questions and frustrations perhaps.
Okay, part of the point of this talk is to kind of emphasise that, yes, it might seem that we're not getting very far very fast, but the bourgeoisie fell at the first hurdle, and you know it took them a while, and they got back up, and eventually they won. So that's kind of like taking the very, very, very long perspective. And at the time we're talking about, in some ways, you could have argued that when Will Withers was attacking the church was the more progressive of the bodies, because it was a universal body across the entirety of Europe that was making various claims, and that when you come back to the whole nationalisation via the dissolution of the monasteries, which is something I really want to read up and talk about more, as kind of like the foundational element of the birth of capitalism in this country, was based on destroying those progressive elements of the universal church. And I'll just reiterate what I said last night, which is that from our point of view, it's that the party has a materialist position that there's not going to be any god or any non-man-made entities that are going to come along and make socialism for us. And whilst we don't denigrate or reject people who might happen to have some sort of faith, but in terms of the party being a practical tool for a materialist revolutionary set of ideas, we restrict membership to people who agree with that materialist outlook. And what we tend to find, if we start allowing Quakers to join, is that they would start to put things from a moral point of view, start from the ideas first, rather than building from the practical sociological approach that we take, which is that revolution is not going to come about because people think it's a good idea in the abstract. It's only going to be when the ideas agree with their lived experience and it becomes a necessity for people. And quite how this comes about is the killer question for us. And at the present moment, as we understand it, the impetus to become revolutionary, whilst it has occurred sporadically at various points, it needs some sort of changing conditions at the point where people are going to have to go. I often use the example, borrowing from medieval anti-communist literature, of the Aesop's fable, The Belling of the Cat. They would.
Who's going to bell the cat? It's a mega tune.
And of course, the feudal anti-communist goes, well, no one dares bell the cat because the cat is a feudal knight, and all these mice are just frightened and running away from it. Whereas we're saying, well, not only do we know how the cat will be belled, we will know that with our materialist case as an argument, that eventually we will be compelled to bell the cat, and we will find the way to do it, and that will be the revolutionary, I don't want to say revolutionary moment, the revolutionary process.
No.
Just Adam's dad? I'm sorry, I don't know your name, Adam's dad. Jim?
Yeah. I can see in years to come the SPGB becoming Sharia party of Great Britain, because we've got Islam becoming stronger and stronger.
Is that, sorry?
Sharia law.
Sharia law.
Islamic law, yeah?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so what's happening is that especially in the Anglican Church in the United Kingdom, is going down the hill fast. Mm-hmm. I live on the border of two dioceses. One is Rochester and the other one is in London, UBC.
Strewed.
If I step inside the church on a Sunday, I will automatically tie up to pay a tax to Rochester. Part of what you give, part of that goes to Rochester. That was over head count. And around London, when a lot of churches close, they're immediately taken over by mosques, that they are converted into mosques. Now, Sharia law has already encroached to some extent into United Kingdom law. And I can see the dominant party being Islam, and they could even become the state church in time. So, getting back to what Lady was saying up there, the socialist revolution may come from religion, which we are against, but it may come via that. If you look at the Quran, there's a lot of good socialist things in it, like if a boy steals from a market, you mustn't punish the boy if he's hungry. So there's a lot of things like that, but there's also a lot of very bad things as well. But we mustn't close our eyes to think that it won't come from there, because it could possibly come from there, you know?
Hang on, I'd like to... Come back if I may. All I said is that Islam, just like Christianity, has always shown its capacity to adapt to the circumstances of the society it's in. So Christianity, which has every bit as much of an injunction against usury as Islam, has been managed to become perfectly comfortable with banks and interest. And in fact, Islam, in many years, has been perfectly comfortable with banks and paying of interest. And this is a, this is why we have a materialist case, because what we would say is, you know, just like as Cromwell was a Christian fundamentalist. But the it's not the ideas that determine the history and the way things are. And if we found ourselves in a capitalism where everyone was professing to be Islamic, we would still find them behaving in the way of being a capitalist, and they would adapt their ideas to the way in which they live. And so I would not pick out Sharia law to be opposed any more than any other type of capitalist law. Because if there's any part element of Sharia that gets in the way of capitalism, it gets set to one side fairly quickly. Actually, if you read the early Muslim church, would be perfectly compatible with a kind of like Proudhonite anarchism. The only thing we have, you know, to talk about Islamic culture or anything like that, as Maxime Rodinson, the Marxist Orientalist, says, it's not that there's been a monolithic Islam, it's just there's been a consistency of civilization in one particular part of the world for a very, very long time, and that the religion has adapted to the ways of life from that fairly consistent existence. And we suggest that you know, as someone who quoted the full Marx quote about the opiate of the people, the soul of the soulless world, the heart's cry of the oppressed, that when we have a world in which we are in control of our world around us, we no longer experience our lived experience through an alienated world, that we would no longer have a need for religion, because the functions and the function of religion in the mind would no longer be necessary. And where once religion was the vanguard of science, the way we explained how the world worked, and it's been pushed out of natural science, out of astronomy, and all it's got left now is a kind of like rudimentary social science. That too can be pushed out when we have a society in which we are in conscious control of our own daily lived existence.
Glenn?
I was only two points really. One was addressing Kathy's point really. I would imagine that, like a lot of people new to this, she described to me as someone who's very empathetic and a caring person. And I think that by dint of the fact she's that sort of person, and I think I've seen it before, people therefore have a natural tendency to want to sort of be inclusive, and that's quite understandable. And you could be inclusive about any number of issues. And that's people with certain beliefs, or people who maybe believe that the Amazon rainforest shouldn't be destroyed, or whatever it is. And then it becomes slightly a single issue. What I think can happen is that people very easily get befuddled, and I don't mean that as an insult to Patty at all, but with the minutiae of the state of things, if you like. And I would say that sometimes it's worth sweeping everything off the table and being very simplistic about how one looks at this and saying, is this current system working well? Is it as simple as that? Is it working, and what is it doing for people? And I think if you basically believe that it isn't, then you're 99% of the way there anyway without a revolution. And I say without a revolution because if the vast majority of people come around to thinking this isn't working, you're nearly there. And lastly, on the subject of time, I'm sure most people here have come across this chap, Jim Bevel, who's written a paper called Deep Adaptation. And he's a professor. He's studied a great deal of climate science and glaciology and all the issues surrounding climate science. And he has quite simply concluded it's too late now anyway to change, if you like. And if you read his paper, his name is Jim Bengel. You can Google that and find it. So what he now believes, we need to be in a state of considering that it is too late. Society is going to collapse in a very huge and dramatic way now. And so we now have to look at how we then deal with that and deal with the grief of what will ultimately be loss of people and species and the environment. It's a bit of a, sort of, one might say, a disturbing paper, but he goes into great detail about why scientists even themselves don't like this paper, because they say, oh, we can't say this to the public, because you know, and all this sort of stuff. But so coming back to the point of time, it is seriously in need of change, society. Yeah.
Thank you.
Would you please say the name of the...
Would you please say the name of the paper again? Well, it's called Deep Adaptation, I think. Yeah. If you Google Deep Adaptation, and the Professor Jim Bendel, I think it's about B-E-N-D-A-L-L.
Thank you.
You think one make happy with...
No, you want nightmares. Nightmares, Janet.
Just to add to the ones I already have.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Tim. Tim, you wanted to...
Yeah, just going back to the idea of religion, I think the way you express it, Bill, in terms of a sort of structured, conventional, sociological concept of religion, is okay, but I don't think that's the end of it, really, because if you take all the other incremental aspects that are non-organised religion, so that would be... internal spirituality, looking inwards, and externally looking at the universe and believing there's something more than we currently know, metaphysical aspects. And then think about all the people then that are striving for something, not necessarily to believe in a god or a faith or supernatural in the sense of, you know, an all-powerful being, but just striving in the spiritual sense for a better life. Control their own life and perhaps live in a community that are agreeable to them. I think, you know, all those people are potentially, you know, sympathetic to socialist principles. You know? So I think we need to separate the kind of concept of organized religion and deity and almighty from all the other spiritual stuff, looking inwards emotionally. And looking at metaphysical aspects that we now I'm not able to understand or explain by science, but in years to come may well be seen as scientific.
Yeah, you make a good point, I disagree about that. This is getting to internal party arguments about the distinction between organised and disorganised religion. I think it comes down very much to the positive case that the party is materialist, and as long as people understand that whatever spirituality they have stems from their material conditions and their lived experience, and are prepared to accept that that's how it's come about, then that's fine. And as I said, you know, there's no talk about getting rid of it, the sublime feeling or anything like that. And I'm quite amenable to the authors. Joyce O'Flannery wrote a book on the origins of inequality, and they make a very good case for in very primitive human society. I think they were kind of riffing on Freud. Religion comes about as a way of equalising everyone. So they got rid of the pack alpha, the group alpha, and everyone, there is no alpha among them. God is the alpha, and everyone is the gamma males below God. And that might well have been a very successful egalitarian move in a primitive society, but I don't. That's one that works among a very small group of people, and the problem comes later on when a leader then manages to monopolise God. And as the king, to return to the theme of the talk, says, I am God's anointed and in the great chain of being, and therefore it takes on this awesome sort of like sublime powers that belong in this sort of like realm of the divine. And of course, all human societies have some sort of congregation that involves changing states of consciousness. So people dance, they sing, they expend lots of energy together, you know, some of these things that are associated with religious rites to the edge. And I would, you know, it's not my revolution if I can't dance, or whatever the fella said. And indeed, I can't dance. You don't want to see it. But it comes back to, as the case is, that we're putting forward a materialist case that says that religion springs from the structure of the human mind, the structure of our society and our lived experience, and it's not necessarily the fact of organised religion. It is the set of ideas of someone saying, well, I believe because I believe and it's my choice. So I think that's where we start to get into more of a fundamental dispute. And again, as I said last night, we don't turn on to religious people and say, you can have no role whatsoever in the party's life and activity. What we say is that you can't have a vote on the party's policy and be a member in that sense.
Sibeli?
Yeah, it's just adding that to what we've been taking up, what we've been saying. And then I find what one thing I'd like to understand is that if you're a capitalist, you have to say we're all capitalists because we live in a capitalist system. Whatever your religion or whatever you live in a commune which is completely isolated from thing, and what we want is socialism. And the religion and this what is religion and what was and the political parties. So it's not because religion is not important. You know that historically religion is just a way of control people, and we're not saying as well about spirituality, because that's what I don't think the socialists not mentioned. Because if you even see Karl Marx, he talk about spiritual thing, but you have to understand that a religion has a structure. It's like monarchy with few followers and people's vote of their parties. And to understand that what religion was, why are we going to get this, have to understand materialism and Marxism itself, I think. Bill, if you think you do the thing with me, just to understand the structure we want is just socialism. What's socialism? Socialism is peace, equality, simple standards of life with common understanding, mutual respect. And then that's why I think we don't like, not to say you don't like religious people, I don't think that's what our party advocate. But just to understand, you have to take the problem, which is materialism, capitalism, and the profit and the currency and all this oppression of believing on something that might be feeling good, but really, in general, doesn't, because actually what we need here is socialism, exactly to avoid not this form of oppression, as well saving the planet, and stop doing stupid things just because whatever they said 1904 on 15th century before Christ. Understand? So I think this is the party that we don't, I think we looking forward to get that. Separate yourself from know yourself. Be a communal without those kind of segments of party. And I think the Socialist Party, and I think about that quite a lot. Why? How many socialist parties do we need to be socialist? And how much? And the conservative or whatever you keep, you change Brexit, black shit. How are we gonna? Kind of European Union and things, and understand the United States or United States of America. So that is the problem. If it's making people understand what is socialism and what this capitalist system really is to win it.
Okay, wait. Do you want to?
I've got nothing to
add. Okay, right, we're running out of time, so before Jim, before I go to you, is there anyone else that hasn't spoken that would like to? Right, Eddie.
Going back to the past this morning, and I'd like to go back to yesterday and a vision of a socialist society in the future. Does socialism embrace technology, tools of capitalism like automation, AI, not mass production that is ruining the planet, but how is the technology of capitalism embraced by socialism, or is it all just scooped up and put in the land thing.
Well, rattling up very briefly, the technology that it has come into being in capitalism is not inherent to capitalism, and comes from associated production, which is us working together. Now, we would use the skills and the resources and the technology that we've already developed to ensure that we feed, clothe and house every man, woman and child on earth and do it for about 2 days' work a week each. So we would have to use some parts of the technology, but we don't rely on the technology, and I would argue that socialism would be possible with pencil and paper as much as it would be with advanced computer technology.
See, I guess I didn't understand the last phrase.
It would be, we could organise socialism using pen and paper just as well as it by using advanced computer technology, but we've got the computers now, so we can use them.
Okay.
Brian. Mine.
Right, just a reflection on religion. If you look at the relationship between religion and politics throughout history, it's been extremely complex. In some situations, it's been quite progressive, you know, with somebody like Winstanley, okay? But for most of human history, religion has been a very retrogressive force, actually. There is no tyrant in history, no matter how bloodthirsty, has not sanctified himself by recourse to religion. And if you look at around the world today, at all the countries around the world, you'll see there's unholy alliance, whether you're talking about Burma, whether you're talking about Turkey, whether you're talking about Saudi Arabia, whether you're talking about India, whether you're talking about Israel. In all these countries, there's an unholy alliance between a very authoritarian state, a support of capitalism, and promoting religion as a state ideology. You know, and they've all, throughout history, they've gone together. Economic inequality, a government that supports the system, and sanctified by religion, you know? Which doesn't mean, though, of course, in certain contexts and with certain people, religion can have been progressive. But looking at history as a whole, actually, religion is not a thing to support.
One last...
Can I ask, just following on from that, I mean, what role did the church play in the events in the 14th century?
The church was entirely entwined with the state. So the bishops were on one side or another, and I mean, as the whole thing was about, as I said, you know, the capacity to appoint priests and the like, and the control of the state. I don't recall the church having anything much of a separate position, except that the intervention of the Pope to annul Henry's oath on the provisions of Oxford. I think we can possibly run at 10 past, do you think?
Oh, yeah, sure.
There seems to be a lot of hands.
Yeah, it does. Okay, who was... Okay, this young chap. Okay.
Thanks for the talk.
The foot off the session.
I'm just wondering, a historical perspective is interesting and obviously necessary to inform our understanding, but given that there is no precedent for the revolution that we're talking about with a mass consciousness and not replacing the ruling class with an alternative ruling class, how can we use history to interpret the elements of a successful revolution? For example, what proportion of the population would need to have an understanding of socialism for this to be successful?
Ooh, tricky questions. So, very quickly then, I think that at the very least, understanding the specific concrete nature, so not turning it into a schematic of, you know, this is what a bourgeois revolution looks like, but looking at each of the revolutions as a concrete thing, and how it related specifically to the conditions in which it was being undertaken of human... I should have put this at the front of the thing. Where historical materialists, human beings make history, but not in conditions of their own choosing. The medieval people were perfectly rational, you know, so when you hear stories about, you know, they put a pig on trial, I can just imagine it would be like an SPGB committee. Someone's going, how the hell do we sort this mess out? What have we got here? I know, let's put the pig on trial. Yeah, that works. What a load of nonsense. What have we got to do? You know, that's, you know, these things that are used to mock medieval times. But, you know, these were rational people doing them. Interesting, in conditions where the tools were of a particular type. We want to get the position where there's a little footnote in Marx where he's describing the commune. He says, you know, there'll be in Germany there'll be a government of 6 million members. The population of Germany at that time was 6 million. So he's clearly got this idea that at some point everyone's got to buy on board. And even if in terms of sheer naked politics, you need 30% of the vote to be form a government in any rational representative election, but we're looking for more than that, and overwhelming. But we could say that, you know, if we have a preponderant minority, and then the rest fall in line later, you know. But we can't say for certain. We're not going to turn around and say unless we get 17.5 million votes, it's not happening. What we had to do is say the unambiguous and clear ongoing consent of everyone, and the idea that the old way cannot and will no longer continue. And I think that's once we say it's gone, you know, which they weren't prepared to do to Henry. They were not prepared to turn around to Henry and say the old way cannot continue, i.e. you're out, and we're doing away with kings forever. That's the point we need to get to, is that it's over.
Sandy, you wanted to
One comment and a question. First question, is this policy of religion consistent throughout the world? So, Socialist Party of Great Britain, is it the same like in Ireland, Canada? That's my question.
Yes.
My comment is...
Short answer.
Just thinking about religion today, the numbers are declining, you know, significantly. I mean, the numbers of the 10 church that prescribed to be Christian is not what it was in 1904. You know, very few people attend church, and I know for a fact that senior level, they're looking at restructuring parishes because numbers have, you know, gone down so much. You know, so merging parishes, so, yeah, fewer clergy. And I think that we don't live in a society where people have got the same allegiance anymore. And so what I'm hearing today, what I seem to be hearing, is this collapsing of religion and faith in a way that I don't think has taken us forward. And I totally get the point that the gentleman on my left made about, you know, the impact that religion has had historically. I 100% agree with that, but I'm just thinking today, religion is almost marginal, you know. I think that people, there are much more people with faith out there, and if I might say so, I think that for a revolution to happen and be real, it's going to take faith, a lot of faith.
Well, so the short answer to your first question is yes, the party is consistent in all its branches. I think the Americans might be more towards Tim's position of admitting people with vague spirituality, and there's members in this country who would agree with that position. And it, you know, we debate it out from time to time because we're a democratic party, and the place. But I mean, I would come to the point. Look at what's happening to the debate today, where a discussion about the history of evolution, it seems to be veering into a discussion of religion. This is what happens when religion works its way into things, I think, very much. But on the point you make about the revolution will require faith, I think this comes down to, what do you mean by faith? Do you mean that people have to believe that it's going to work? And I think that will have to be based on a scientific belief. That we have this knowledge of how to run a world that we've already acquired, and then we're not going to throw it away. And if you call that belief and faith, well, fine. But I'd call that a scientific belief.
Yes.
Okay, Jim.
If you look at the Crusades and the early popes, and a lot of evil there. But if you can separate the Trinity and the Son of God and get back to Jesus as a person, would you class him as the first socialist? And if you think that all the rough sleepers could become lepers, we class them as lepers, which they are demonised. You mustn't feed them, you mustn't give them money. You know, the church benches are segregated so they can't lay out. And if you look at a lot of things that Jesus done, I'm not pumping religion, because I'm not. I'm saying that look at Jesus as a socialist. He was a person that didn't like money lenders. He didn't like tax collectors. He didn't like synagogues. He would rather preach in a field, just a plain field. And he was caring, he was giving, and he was sharing. If we, and I'm not saying this from a religious point of view, I must say, but if we fixated on something like that, we could accelerate the numbers hugely in the socialist workers' party.
Somebody
please explain. Just
hold on a minute. Can you sit down a minute, please?
No, I'm.
Okay, you're leaving. Okay. Okay, yeah, sure.
Before I go with his question, I'd just like to inform that out there, there is a scientific religion and it's growing very quickly and Sherry Wallis.
Oh, she's doing a protest.
No, it's not a protest, it's an information.
Well, we're having a talk here, a discussion.
Right.
Continue.
So.
Okay.
All I'll add is that there's a very fine book by Karl Kautsky, which is, you know, historically possibly a little bit inaccurate. It's aged a bit, but the origins of the myth of Jesus and the religion itself has a material and a historical origin in the form of what was going on in the birth of the Roman Empire, and whatever ideas sprang from that, some of which have been retained through the centuries since and adapted through time to fit in with whatever is going on and the situation in society. But that means that we have to rely on our materialist and historical analysis to understand these things, and that to say that socialism doesn't arise just from a set of moral precepts. It arises from the actual condition of one, human beings being human beings, and to the social situation that we find ourselves in, and that we seek to change and express ourselves as complete human beings and unalienated human beings.
Okay, and the last word, perhaps?
Very briefly, in regard to someone from the back, I don't know who, it's not a problem, who mentioned that churches, I think he said in England, when they closed, were made into mosques. Did I hear correctly?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Well, come to London and see the lovely one-bedroom flats. Come and have a look at the studio flats that no one can afford, or the social housing that many churches have been turned into. And they look very nice in the Brixton area, South London. I can talk about it because I know people who actually volunteer at our party who live in one of them. And we're the social party for anyone who's not quite got it.
Socialist party, not of Great Britain.
The
socialist party.
Okay, it is lunchtime.
Thank you. Thank you. That's my question.
Some announcements.
One moment. Pause up. Can we thank Mike?
Yes, absolutely.